One thing we got over here is a lot of hope, all right? That's how we run the fishery, on hope.
Yukon commercial fishermen get chum openings and much-needed cash. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 9th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new book that traces the language connection between a remote Siberian village and tribes in Alaska and the lower 48.
This language link is something that is a very strong new contribution to that understanding.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Commercial fishermen on the Yukon River are getting a chance to earn some money. The Department of Fish and Game has been allowing some openings on the river in an effort to target summer chum. But fishermen had to wait first while the bulk of the run swam past their villages. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel has more.
Kuikpak Fisheries is the largest salmon buyer on the Yukon River, and running that operation each year is a big question mark, says Kuikpak manager Jack Schulteis.
It's been really difficult on the Yukon, you know, because it's been so unreliable.
This year, the Department of Fish and Game made plans to close all commercial fishing until the majority of the Yukon King Run had passed through the lower river. By now, most of those kings have moved on, so Fish and Game has opened fishing for summer chums in the two lowest districts. There's been a total of 5 openings so far.
The workers are happy. They got plenty of work. The fishermen seem okay. Everybody's pretty content over here. But they naturally want more fish.
According to the Department of Labor, the lower Yukon is the most impoverished area of the state, and many rely on the fisheries there to scrape out a living. But many of the summer chum they were hoping to catch were swimming with the kings earlier this summer. That means the best fishing has already passed.
So what that means is we are allowing a large surplus of chum to go by these lower river districts unharvested because they're running at the same time these kings are running. So we're basically getting started fishing on the chums pretty late.
Steve Hayes is a fish and game biologist in Emonok at the mouth of the Yukon. Had the King Run been more plentiful, Fish and Game could have opened up commercial fishing earlier. But Hayes says it's looking like another year that's well below the average for kings.
From what we've seen right now, you know, we're kind of projecting that we're going to be at the low end of our preseason projection.
Fish and Game is now estimating that about 155,000 kings have entered the Yukon. They were hoping for as many as 210,000. Hayes says future sonar counts will help finalize that number. Meanwhile, the Yukon summer chum run looks to be in good shape. Fish and Game estimates that about 1 million of them have already passed through when they began the openings last week. That means a surplus for commercial harvest. With 4 of 5 openings tallied, they say about 109,000 chums have been sold so far. Jack Schulteis says the average take-home pay for fishermen is around $700 an opening.
It's, you know, kind of hit and miss. One opening you do real well, the next opening, you know, you just kind of scratch fishing.
And while catches may be down, prices are up.
You know, they're getting a decent price for fish. It's keeping people going.
Kuikpak is buying at 70 cents per pound. That's a 20-cent increase over last year's prices. That's in part because demand is up a bit and supply is down across the state. But Schulteis says the Yukon benefits from enthusiastic buyers in the lower 48 that are willing to stick with the troubled fishery.
The customers that have stuck it out with us, they really like our fish. They work with us on, you know, ad campaigns and promotions.
The end of summer management for the Yukon is July 15th. That gives just a few more chances for summer chum openings.
We're hoping and praying, okay? One thing we got over here is a lot of hope, all right? It's how we run the fishery, on hope.
In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A major hatchery chum salmon run that provides early season opportunity for Southeast's purse seine fleet is falling short of expectations. Returns of dog salmon to the Hidden Falls hatchery on Baranoff Island have been lower than the preseason forecast. The total return to the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association's hatchery was expected to be 1.6 million chums. Ensurah General Manager Steve Reifenstuhl says that as of July 7th, they've only accounted for 20% of the forecast, or 334,000 fish.
So we're a bit behind the curve. We don't expect the return to meet forecast. I think it could come in around a million at this point. We have had late returns that peak on the 15th, but normal peak of the return is July 9th or 10th.
Reifenstuhl says he thinks the run has almost reached its peak already and says it's not good news for people hoping to catch a lot of Hidden Falls chum.
It's unfortunate in a year like this where the pink forecast is low and not looking like it's going to be off of what the department has forecast. We really needed a big chum run at Hidden Falls, certainly at least as big as the forecast, and it looks like that's not going to happen. That's terribly unfortunate.
Prior years have seen big returns of Hidden Falls chums and two openings a week in that area for the seine fleet. The hatchery dogs take some fishing pressure off wild pink salmon runs in the early season, especially in a year with a lower pink salmon run forecast. But the fleet has had reduced fishing time this month. Ensurah is working to catch chum for brood stock, the next generation of fish, as well as cost recovery fish, which help pay for operating the facility. At the end of the first week of July, the hatchery had caught only 4% of its brood stock goals and 30% of cost recovery goals. However, Reifenstuhl says he thinks Ensurah will meet both those goals.
You know, it may mean, or it's going to mean, that we're going to have to be very conservative on reopening to make sure we meet those goals. But one thing I won't let happen is not meeting the broodstock goal, because that affects the future. We could recover from not getting all our cost recovery, but not, you know, we would affect the future fisheries on broodstock.
The seine catch after the first week in July totaled 265,000 fish at Hidden Falls. The effort has been as high as 100 boats fishing for the hatchery chums, and prices are high for seine-caught chum this summer, around 70 to 75 cents a pound. The Interior Department is offering 1.8 million acres for oil and gas leases in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve, while promising to protect critical migratory bird and caribou habitat. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says the department, through the Bureau of Land Management, will offer 190 tracts with bids to open August 11th in Anchorage. The Petroleum Reserve covers 23 million acres on Alaska's North Slope. The BLM withdrew for consideration lands in a buffer zone around Teshikpuk Lake because of its importance to migratory birds. Eric Myers of Audubon Alaska says the agency took a reasonable approach with its measures to protect birds and calving caribou. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, building nature trails that work with, not against, the landscape.
These trails are here for people to interact with the environment. So if you have to duck and go around, and if you touch something, that's all the better.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
State officials are trying mediation to settle an ongoing dispute over fast ferry engines. The Department of Law filed a lawsuit in March over continuing problems with equipment powering the ferries Fairweather and Chenega. The suit named Director, the East Coast shipyard that built the vessels, as well as the German company that made the engines. The parties were already discussing solutions when the lawsuit was filed. Marine Highway General Manager John Falvey says talks are ongoing.
We are in the process of mediating that situation as to how we remedy the situation of the engines that do have a mechanical problem. And that's an ongoing thing with the Attorney General's office.
The Fairweather and Chenega are 235-foot aluminum-hulled catamarans. The Juneau base Fairweather sails to Sitka, Petersburg, Haines, and Skagway. The Cordova base Chenega sails to Valdez and Whittier. Both carry up to 35 vehicles and 250 passengers. Falvey says one solution would be to replace the engines. Only 8 were made, 4 each for the two ferries. But he says another widely used engine could probably substitute.
They are, a very high horsepower, lightweight, highly turbocharged engine, and they tend to operate at the edge of their operational envelope. They're, under a lot of stress and strain.
The Chenega just underwent its first major overhaul, which cost about $5.2 million. The ferry tied up in Ketchikan, and its engines were removed and shipped to Kent, Washington for repairs. It's the same overhaul the Fairweather underwent a year ago.
We completely dismantle those engines. Every single part is inspected. New parts where needed, and remanufacturing and conditioning of things. And those engines were completely and inspected, checked, and put back together. And we have the boat operating again.
The Chenega resumes sailing in Prince William Sound on July 1st. Falvey says it will run through the winter. Officials earlier said the lightweight ship might not be able to handle the weather. Barth Hamburg's trails are known for their scenic meanderings, natural contours, and forward-thinking sustainability. The Forest Service landscape architect is known throughout Alaska, and he says his work represents a whole new way of thinking about trail building as a window into the natural world. KCAW's Lily Mihalik reports.
Barth Hamburg is a Harvard-trained landscape architect, but he first earned his stripes with the Forest Service as a volunteer flying over Alaska, rating landscapes for their scenic beauty. Nowadays, Hamburg spends more time on the ground, but his aesthetic eye is as strong as ever.
The Forest Service, traditionally our design approach is to try to interpret nature for people, and so when I'm working on designing a trail, what I want to do is to try to route the trail in such a way that I'm going to expose the natural features to the greatest possible effect.
Hiking up Hamburg's Herring Cove Trail, he points out one such highlight.
We're looking at this gigantic boulder. It's taller than a bus, not quite as long, but it came down off of Bear Mountain here, and then it stopped and split right in half, and you can walk through this crack between these two, and it towers over your head. So the trail kind of had to go through it just because to walk through something like this is such a, a wild experience.
In another portion of the trail, moss hangs loosely off a fallen log that creates a sort of archway over the trail. Walking up to that log, Hamburg smiles and explains physical interaction with the environment is just as important as the scenery.
You actually have to kind of duck under it to pass. And the standard specification for this would be to cut this thing out. There shouldn't be anything within 7 feet above the trail. But, these trails are here for people to interact with the environment. So if you have to duck and go around and if you touch something, that's all the better.
Hamburg says Sitka has a lot to offer in terms of natural beauty, but building trails in southeast Alaska is especially difficult compared to other terrain around the United States.
The thing that's specific to southeast Alaska is we don't really have soil that you can build a trail on. Our soil is organic matter over bedrock, and so pretty much every foot of most trails has to be surfaced in some manner. There's a few exceptions to that, but so it's a very it's an expensive proposition. So in order to be efficient, it's got to be laid out really well.
This terrain, says Hamburg, calls for a special approach, one where he uses numbered stakes to mark each step, log, and drainage along the trail. These stakes then correspond to a spreadsheet that tells contracted trail builders the exact design Hamburg has in mind.
It's a field-based approach to design rather than going out and surveying a whole site and bringing it back in the office and designing in the office. You need to lay it out in the field and do those measurements in the field and put the stake exactly where you want it because you might tell them you want to save this particular route to use as a step.
David Crowell works for Clarence McReynolds Trail Building, based out of Whitebird, Idaho, the company that bid on and won Sitka's Beaver Lake project. He's one of the people that reads these stakes and says perhaps the hardest part of trail building in Alaska is the wet weather.
Where we're from in Idaho, where average rainfall is about 8 inches a year. That's about 8 inches a day, I think, yesterday here. I'm pretty sure that's what we got.
Sitka's climate also affects trail sustainability, a major concern in Sitka, where trail building is especially expensive. It's things like wood rot and erosion that have given Hamburg the most trouble, and sometimes his own design.
The Gavin Hill Trail, which was is a giant set of stairs that people pretty much universally hate because it's so hard on your knees and it's really, you know, it's just not very good walking experience. So we learned from that we should try to do something different, which is to reduce the slope, not necessarily always stick to the original alignment. That was just created probably by some guy with a chainsaw that wanted to go deer hunting a long time ago.
It's lessons and obstacles like these that continue to inform Sitka's trails.
So we're really going towards trying to build more sustainable trails that are going to last for the long run. Kind of think more like the Incas rather than think, you know, over like a 20-year lifespan.
Reporting from the Beaver Lake and Herring Cove Trails in Sitka, this is Lily Mihalik.
A new book chronicles the language link between a remote village in northern Siberia and the Diné or Athabascan family of languages in North America. The Ket people of the Yenisei River have been studied by Professor Edward Vida, a linguistics expert from the Western Washington University. Vida says there are about 30 languages in Siberia that are not related to Russian, and Ket is one of them. He says it is radically different than any other language of North Asia.
It appeared to have a system of tones in it, whereas none of the other languages of the North had tones. And it also had a verb that had a whole bunch of prefixes. The root, the main meaning of the verb was at the very end, and then there's prefixes that tell you the time and the duration and who did the action and who it was done to. All of those were prefixes, and that's unique in the northern landlocked Asia.
Vida says no one from North America had ever worked with the Ket language before. He says Ket is the only surviving language of the Yeniseian family. Other native languages along the Yenisei River are extinct.
So that family is called the Yeniseian, and then Madene is about 30 Athabascan languages over on the American side, plus Tlingit in the Alaska Panhandle and parts of British Columbia and Yukon. And then also there's an extinct language, Eyak, that was spoken in Alaska. This is not Diné family.
The story of language loss in remote Siberia is similar to native language loss in North America. Under Stalin, the Soviet government forced nomadic reindeer herders and hunters into villages in the 1930s and 40s, and then took their children away to boarding schools to learn Russian in the 50s and 60s. Vida says today, of the 1,200 Ket people, fewer than 100 elders speak the language.
Ket children that I met in the village, they knew some words of Ket and could understand a little bit of the language, but none of them were able to carry on a conversation.
Vida says it depresses him to realize that within the next century or so, there may only be 1,000 of the world's 5,000 languages still being spoken. He says the geologic evidence of a land bridge between Asia and North America stands on its own, and it's known that people related to native people in Alaska came across by boat after the area flooded. So it's possible people walked long ago or more recently boated across, but he can't say which direction people may have gone.
I know many Native American communities, their traditions, their beliefs have them always being in this area and not coming from another continent. So I, as a linguist, really can't say who went where. The only thing I can, or when did this happen, the only thing I can really say is that there is a language connection and that at some point these languages come from a common source.
The research does show an ancient connection between Native people of Asia and North America.
This language link is something that is a very strong new contribution to that understanding.
The book examines culture, change, language, and genetics, and is called The Diné Yeniseian Connection. It's a publication of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Department of Anthropology and the Alaska Native Language Center. To hear a Ket story about a woman who turns herself into a bird, go to our website, aprn.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
The Colorado-based Keystone Center has been hired by the Pebble Partnership to bring stakeholders together to talk about the proposed Pebble Mine through a series of panel discussions beginning later this year. The Keystone Center was contracted in 2008 by global mining giant Anglo-American with the Pebble Limited Partnership to analyze Pebble's environmental and socioeconomic baseline studies and share that information with the public. The Keystone Center plans to hold the first of four panel discussions regarding the proposed Pebble Mine later this year in Anchorage. Todd Bryan is a senior executive at the center. He says the first panel discussion in early December will focus on responsible, large-scale mining from a global perspective.
What we're going to try to do is to bring in people from around the United States and Canada and other parts of the world that have had experiences with modern large-scale mining projects. And they're going to talk about their perspectives and their experiences with those kinds of mining activities.
Bryan says the panel has already been selected and will have a number of people who are experienced with fisheries and copper and gold mines. The panel consists of five scientists with experience in either fisheries biology or mining. Bryan says the idea of the panel is to have a balanced overall viewpoint regarding the proposed mining project.
Some people will be more skeptical of large-scale mining and whether it's feasible in a region like this, and other people will be more, I think, probably optimistic that it's doable, so that we can get a kind of broad perspectives.
Despite the fact that the Pebble Partnership is funding work done by the Keystone Center, Bryan claims that the group was hired because of its ability to be impartial and work independently. Kim Williams is the executive director of Nunumta Aluksti, an environmental conservation group based in Dillingham that opposes the mine's development. She says she would have questions about how a group funded by the Pebble Partnership could remain neutral.
When you're taking Pebble project money, how do you maintain that independence and impartiality? And that, to me, proof is in the pudding, and we'll have to wait to see when they start their meetings this winter.
The panel members will come from across the world. Bryan says that originally the panel was supposed to be held last year. However, that had to be delayed until this winter because they were waiting for the Pebble Partnership to release all of the socioeconomic and environmental baseline studies.
They were scheduled to be released in the fall of 2009. And we were planning on starting our panels about a year ago and had talked to a lot of people up there about starting them. We had our science advisory committee up there in May of 2009. But Pebble wasn't ready to release the studies. So they weren't comfortable releasing the studies before they were quality controlled with internally. And so they delayed that for a year.
Bryan will be visiting Bristol Bay in late July and is interested in meeting with any people or organizations who would like to talk about the Keystone process. Kim Williams with Nunumta Aluksti says she welcomes the opportunity to meet Bryan when he comes to Bristol Bay.
Yeah, we're not, you know, Nunumta's not adverse to talking to any group or organization. We've approached the Pebble Partnership that whenever we travel around the region and hold community meetings, we've always invited the Pebble Partnership. And so the same would be for Dr. Bryan from the Keystone Center, that we would welcome an opportunity to talk to him, to raise some of our questions about the independence and impartiality and how the Keystone Center is approaching this, the independence, and taking a look at how citizens can be involved and evaluate whether or not Pebble baseline studies are available and even to comment on.
The first panel discussion is scheduled for December at the University of Alaska Anchorage campus. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she wants to keep trying to reach agreement on the controversial Sea Alaska lands legislation. Murkowski visited Petersburg and several other southeast communities earlier this week. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Murkowski took questions from a small gathering of Petersburg residents and said she wanted the regional Native corporation to get the land it's entitled to under the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
We need to resolve, bring to conclusion the conveyances that that Sea Alaska is entitled to under ANCSA. And we need to try to do so in a way that enhances the Southeast economy, not just the Sea Alaska shareholders and their economic interests, but the economy of Southeast as a whole.
Murkowski has sponsored legislation allowing Sea Alaska to go outside of the areas designated by the 1971 Act in selecting its remaining land entitlement. Murkowski told local residents that the bill was needed so Sea Alaska would not be forced to log old-growth timber and in municipal watersheds within the 1971 ANCSA withdrawal areas.
What we're trying to do with this is to limit the environmental impact. And that's why you've seen the efforts with the future sites. You've seen an effort to try to build in some conservation sites, because we're trying to find that balance. And as I mentioned, we may not have found that balance. But at this point in time, we need to keep trying, because if we don't do it, if we decide that we're just going to drop it, the issue does not go away.
Senator Murkowski has posted updated maps on the legislation on her website. She said the Senate's Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where she is ranking Republican, has not yet set a date for markup of the bill and welcomed more public input on the latest changes. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Lily Mahalik in Sitka, and Adam Kane in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine. Thanks to Alaskans like you, Tech Alaska can continue to deliver jobs and benefits for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.